I'm Dr. Leif Tappanilla from the Idaho Museum of Natural History. I'm here with Peter Pruitt from Zoo Idaho. This is The Nature of Idaho. Coming from the 1B, we're talking all about Idaho, its wild places and wild faces, the natural setting that makes Idaho an incredible place to live and be proud of. Today, our guest is Dr. Colden Baxter, professor of biology at Idaho State University, and we'll be talking about life on the river's edge, how animals and plants influence each other on land and in the water.
Leif, we've had a couple episodes about rivers, and it almost feels like we're tying the last bits of pieces together on our rivers in Idaho and looking at the whole big ecology picture of how important rivers are.
Well, if listeners haven't picked up on this already, Idaho really is the river state. We have so much mileage of river in this state, and anyone who lives here lives around them, plays around them, and really depends on our river system. So I'm really excited today to talk about how the living systems integrate with the land and the waterways that we value so much in this state.
Yeah, this is going to be good. But first, as always, we got to get into a little bit of nature news. And this is kind of going to be in your area of expertise, Leif, so I'm excited about this. 252 million years ago, during the Great Dying period, more than 95% of life on Earth over the course of several hundred thousands of years went extinct. Paleontologists from the University of Cincinnati and the China University of Geosciences have found a spike in mercury across geological records around the world. I'm not so familiar with why mercury, but it's something that's been released during volcanic eruptions. And they're finding these spikes, so they're pretty confident that the Great Dying was caused by volcanic eruptions. And they're also pretty confident that these eruptions occurred in the Siberian Traps, which is now, of course, located in central Russia. And these Siberian Traps are a little bit different than the typical volcanoes that us layperson are used to, the cone-shaped volcanoes that make these mountains or these big pillars. These are just gigantic open fissures in the ground. And the eruptions didn't happen in a short period of time, you know, for us, but they happened over hundreds of thousands of years, and these eruptions continued, and there was really no rest in between these eruptions. So this is what they're thinking is really how it affected our environment and resulted in that Great Dying. An example of this is during these eruptions over this time, the Siberian Traps propelled as much as 3 million cubic kilometers of ash into the air. Now, if we compare that to what Mount St. Helens did in the 80s, that was about 1 cubic kilometer, 3 million cubic kilometers versus 1. And what happened is that the Earth ended up warming by about 10 degrees Celsius, which in the comfortable terms for the United States, it's about 50 degrees Fahrenheit. And what they're doing now is they're trying to figure out if the environmental, what was the primary environmental effects from these eruptions that caused this mass extinction?
Yeah, this is we call it the end Permian mass extinction. It's the largest change in life on the planet in the planet's history of certainly animal life. And it's always been a bit of a mystery of how you eradicate 95% of all species. That's quite an impressive and horrifying thought.
And this just isn't land species. This is all species.
All species
in
the ocean.
Ocean life, that's everything,
right.
Yeah.
That's right. And so the this happens to be timed precisely with the largest single volcanic eruption in the history of the planet that we're aware of, which occurred in the Siberia. The traps is an old language term for these large seeps of lava that poured out, much like the Columbia River Plateau basalts, if people are familiar with that, in Oregon and Washington State. But just much, much, much larger and more volume and more stuff getting blasted into the atmosphere. The chemistry must have been quite alarming to any critters that were living around the area at the time. So hopefully we don't see a repeat of anything like that in our lifetimes. But that's a great ancient mystery to piece together some 251 million years ago. There's a happy morning thought for you. Well, maybe something a little different and certainly on topic for today's discussion. You know, it's trivia time. We like to start the show off with a little factoid. So today, our trivia question is, which state ranks number one in the United States per capita water use? That is, how much water is being used divided by the number of people that live in that state? So we'll get to that answer later in the show, but first we need to take a quick little break here.
This is KISU-FM Pocatello, Idaho Falls, Rexburg. Also available on your Amazon or Google smart speaker with the command Play KISU.
Hey, we're back. We want to welcome our guest today, Dr. Colden Baxter. He's a professor of biology at Idaho State University. So thanks for joining us today on The Nature of Idaho.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Well, so Colden is well-regarded here on campus at ISU as being a river doctor. I don't know if you get a degree in riverology, but I'm going to let you explain exactly what it is that you do and what fascinates you about rivers.
Yeah, so I am an ecologist and principally study streams and rivers. I also study the connections between streams and rivers and the land, because rivers and streams are the integrators, really, of the landscapes through which they flow, and they both reflect then, part of what's so fascinating to me about rivers is that they reflect the landscapes and the human, even the human communities through which they flow. And in turn, though, they influence the land and they influence us too. They have strong impacts in lots of different ways on people.
I think it's kind of amazing when you look at the history of rivers and how humanity was kind of dependent upon rivers, and even as advanced as we progress in our society, we are still so dependent upon rivers.
We are. We depend on them in lots of different ways, and our cultures and societies reflect rivers, and we impact them, and we sort of reflect them in our societies and our cultures.
So I think if you live in the southern part of the state of Idaho, you know, the Snake River is the big river that's running east-west through the state. But of course, there are a lot of other rivers that maybe are isolated from the population centers within the state. Could you tell us a little bit about the diversity of river types that we have in Idaho?
Yeah, Idaho is a fantastic place to study, to be a river doctor, to study rivers, in part because of what you describe, that diversity. We have landscapes that are desert, in which the principal streams and rivers are, they really are they could be spring-fed oases, essentially, in the desert, to streams that are ephemeral or intermittent, that's how they are naturally. They're only wet for part of the year. We have everything from those types of streams to rivers that are, giant, dammed rivers, large rivers like the Snake, as you mentioned, and big rivers, some of the wildest rivers remaining in the lower 48 United States, for example, the Salmon River in central Idaho, and the whole snarl of the wild river networks that are really take up the center of our state, for instance. And then we have streams and rivers that drain pockets of essentially temperate rainforest in the northern part of our state, giant cedar trees, for example, with salamanders in them and that sort of thing. So really the full range of climate and stream and river size, and also then the degree to which a range of conditions under which people have either had strong impacts on these streams and rivers, or streams and rivers that have remained relatively, wild in their characteristics.
Well, so I'm wondering, I travel around enough through the state throughout the year. And in the winter, I'm always struck that it's plenty cold outside. There's no rain falling out of the sky. There's no snow melting. Yet the rivers keep flowing. So what drives flow in perennial streams, in streams that continue to flow throughout the year?
Well, some of those are fed by deep groundwater sources, like the spring streams I mentioned. We have a number of those right around our region here in southeast Idaho. And many of those have very stable patterns of flow because they are fed by a deep groundwater source. And then others maintain flow year-round, also because of their connection to groundwater, but typically of shallower sorts. So, for example, water flowing through a shallower hill slope aquifer, for example, and just the oftentimes saturated conditions in the land that's immediately adjacent to and under streams and rivers. And that that landscape serves as a kind of sponge. It soaks up the water, you know, during runoff and precipitation events, and then is slowly releasing it throughout the rest of the year to our streams and rivers.
So how have you seen the landscape get affected by rivers, and then have they been changing over time as land use has changed?
So we're definitely used to thinking about ways in which rivers structure landscapes over long time periods, geologic time periods, centuries, millennia, tens of hundreds of thousands of years or millions of years. So features like the Grand Canyon, for example, are this complex outcome of the interaction between rivers and their landscapes and the tectonics of landscapes. But rivers influence the structure of landscapes in very short time scales too, through annual flooding, patterns of flooding and scour and moving sediments and wood and things like that around. And that's an important part of the dynamics of the landscapes that are affected by rivers. And in turn, of course, we're also we're increasingly aware of the extent to which humans' use of landscapes affect streams and rivers, but through pretty classically understood examples like the delivery of pollution, point and non-point sources of pollution, for instance. Or changes to the river's habitat, for example, when we channelize a river. That changes the nature of the landscape. It changes the relationship between the landscape and a stream or river itself.
Well, let's bring in that biological dimension of, the animals that live and thrive and depend on the river system itself internally, but then the connection to animals and plants that live on the margin of the river, the riparian ecosystem. Could you talk a little bit about what kinds of animals live in the river? I obviously can think of fish, mm-hmm. But living in the in the sands and gravels in the bed of the river itself.
Yeah, so most people are, when they think about the residents of streams and rivers, do think about our fish, and they're very important members of the riverine community. Oftentimes, especially in our region, the greatest diversity of animals, though, actually are the invertebrates. And then, of course, there are all kinds of, in many cases, unknown microbes, the invertebrate community in streams and rivers is really important ecologically.
And they're also really great indicators of water quality or the health of the stream and river too.
We've developed ways of learning about the river's status. So as a river doctor, for instance, one of the things I have to be able to do is turn over a rock or look at a sample from the bed of a river and just based on some of the types of organisms I might see, I might be able to draw some speculation anyway as to the overall health of the river or the extent to which it may be affected by pollution of one sort or another, or loss of certain habitats within it that are required for animals to complete their life cycles.
So obviously those invertebrates that are living in the on the bed of the river mm-hmm. may be a food source for the fish, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. And so there are food webs that exist within the river itself. How do those the connection of foods translate outside of the river itself and start making connections back into the land?
Yeah, so in a lot of streams and rivers, especially in our region, many, if not most, of the invertebrates that are found in these waters are insects. And most of those insects, not all, but most of them, they exist in the stream or river in the aquatic environment in their larval stage. And as many people know, then they, to complete their life cycle, when they're ready, they emerge from the water as winged, air-breathing adults. And when they do this, then they mate, and usually in swarms or in the riparian vegetation, and then the females lay their eggs back in the water. But during this time period of emergence, fishermen often refer to these as hatches. That's, I suppose, technically not exactly what's occurring, but during this emergence event, these insects are not only prey for fish, as most fly fishermen would certainly know, for example, but they also become prey for a wide array of terrestrial insectivores, like birds and bats, lizards, some amphibians, spiders, so on, right? And that connects the web of life then that exists in the river to an array of animals that we usually don't think of as sometimes as being connected to the river.
Because I was going to say, once you've got your first kind of layer of predators, then you can move even further back along the stream edge, river mm-hmm. edge, and then you've incorporated even larger predators.
Yeah, they range from things like spiders that might build their webs right over the top of a small stream that are specialized to capture then these emerging insects, to animals like songbirds or bats that might be foraging at much larger spatial scales and moving all over the landscape, sometimes between the uplands, you know, far away from the stream and river and back to the stream's edge, when depending on time, in some cases on the availability or the pulses of these insect emergence.
So we're looking at animals, insects versus vertebrates, et cetera. Mm-hmm. How does the vegetation around the river then affect the wildlife and the animals that you would typically find there?
Yeah. So for decades now, people like myself who study streams and rivers have understood quite well, and there's a lot of evidence that demonstrates how the character, the amount and composition and character of vegetation along streams and rivers influences the communities and the processes within those these aquatic ecosystems. For example, the seasonally shed leaves that end up in streams form an important component of the base of the food web, fuel that organic matter provides a crucial energy and nutrient supply. And so we've known about those types of connections for quite a long time. And we've also known that the character of vegetation along a stream can exert an influence on the shape of the stream, the shape of the stream's channel, its physical shape, its width and depth and so on, the character of the stream bed material and patterns of erosion and deposition, as we call it. So it affects these physical processes, and the vegetation along the stream, of course, provides organic matter and nutrients that sustain the aquatic food web.
So what's fascinating about this kind of a system is the interconnections, therefore, are become very important. And what if you create a little change on one part of the system, it can have an impact on other parts of the system yeah. through feedback mechanisms, yeah. that kind of thing.
The science of ecology is really, in many ways, it's the science of relationships and connections and consequences. And so especially the type of work that I'm interested in, which is focused on the investigation of these kind of oftentimes extended, indirect, and either unforeseen or even sometimes somewhat invisible connections that occur in nature and that involve rivers.
Well, I'd like to, on that, build on this idea of the connections and sometimes surprising connections that the river may have with or animals and plants that live on land, and a study that you're developing right now in the Yellowstone River system. Is that correct?
Yeah, in the Yellowstone National Park.
The National Park itself, yes. Can you describe a little bit of what that study is hoping to investigate?
Yeah, this is the northern range of Yellowstone National Park, as many people know, provides a really unique opportunity and a kind of ongoing natural experiment that when most people think of that, they think of the land. And on the land there, one of the dramatic changes that's occurred in the last several decades has been the reintroduction of wolves and for that matter, actually, the restoration of a whole assemblage of apex predators, increased numbers of grizzly bears and mountain lions as well. And this has created has contributed to a complex array of responses on the land that are fairly well documented now. And they include the changes in the numbers and the behavior, probably both, of herbivores like elk and deer, especially. The presence of the reintroduced presence of these predators has apparently triggered in some places regrowth or a rebound of this growth of this riparian vegetation that we were discussing. Prior to that, during a period of decades when there were not very many of these top predators and no wolves, many of the riparian zones in the northern range, as it's called, because it's used as wintering range especially for the big elk herds in northern Yellowstone, had become extremely overgrazed, and riparian zones, many of the riparian zones had lost their woody vegetation. They looked like overgrazed pastures, and so in this context, we're really the science that's been done that sort of demonstrates these indirect effects of predators on riparian vegetation, why we're interested in tying that to this idea that we were discussing earlier, that riparian vegetation may itself have various consequences for streams and stream organisms, including those insects that we were talking about, the fish and the insects. What if a change in the terrestrial assemblage of animals and plants could not only might affect streams, their forms or the types of organisms in them, but because so many of those organisms are insects that emerge, what if that effect could essentially continue and propagate or even reverberate, as the term that we're using, bounce back out of the stream to influence animals back on land that depend on those insects? Things like birds and bats and spiders. That is a possibility that is that hasn't really been investigated. For that matter, like extended indirect relationships of that nature haven't been very well studied, those types of extended relationships are not empirically very well demonstrated in general. So Yellowstone provides an opportunity to investigate this possibility, this hypothesis that there may be essentially effects that reverberate between land and water that are maybe triggered initially by a change in the apex predators on land.
That sounds like a lot of field work that you're going to be investing in.
Yes, but not alone. I'm just one of a team of investigators. Actually, I have key collaborators in this effort at Oregon State University, Bob Beshta and Bill Ripple, who've been working in Yellowstone for years and tracking the changes in vegetation and stream channels as this has occurred in some of these streams. And I also have a PhD student here at Idaho State University, Jeremy Brooks, whose investigation is a core component of his dissertation research.
It's a fantastic avenue of research because not just on land, you know, we are reducing and eliminating apex predators across the world. And when you look at some of the major apex predators in the ocean, we really don't know yet what is happening, how it's affecting ocean ecology or, you know, stream ecology or ecology all the way around us. And there's a reason why apex predators are so important, you know, and it's fantastic that we have the opportunity to really start looking and investigating what's happening when they go away or when they come back.
Yeah, we're used to thinking about potentially the consequences for their immediate consequences for their prey, or perhaps another layer or linkage removed from that, the food resources of those organisms. But we've only more recently and in a handful of cases really asked questions about this extended web of relationships and the possibility even that consequences could bounce back and forth amongst habitats beyond the one that is occupied by the predator themselves.
Well, it's a fascinating question to investigate, and we look forward to the results of the research as it develops over the years.
Yeah, it's a brand new project for us, and an interesting and intriguing hypothesis. We'll see whether the evidence is there to support it or not.
Very good. Well, you know, we start off today with a trivia question all about water use. And so the question is, which state ranks number one in the nation for per capita water use? Colton, what's the answer to today's question?
Well, actually, I happen to know that it is Idaho. And which might be surprising to some. But
that's pretty,
we
yeah.
do use a lot of water in this state, especially to support in southern Idaho to support our industrial scale agriculture.
Yeah. Very good.
We want to thank Colton Baxter for joining us today. To learn more about his work, please visit the Idaho State University webpage and the biology department. And shows are recorded here at the studios of KISU Pocatello. Visit us at kisu.org for questions, comments, and audio for all our programs. Our theme music is by Idaho's very own Sons of Bannock. And please remember to get outside and enjoy the nature of Idaho.